Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabeg Akin, the home of the Métis Nation, and the traditional territory of the Nihiyawak and the Dakota. We are your hosts. My name is Kristen Andrews.
And my name is Susan Hubert. In this episode,
we don't believe this is a working democracy when, right from the start, police goes along with the idea that protesters are going to be criminals.
Dr. Ray from the Mindanao and Dr. Sinolandin, they were shot during their duty. So it's very sad.
They're too busy trying to save a pipeline than to save the salmon habitat or the whales.
But first, here are the headlines.
Toronto is hosting its 38th annual Pride Parade on Sunday, June 24th. Over a million festival goers are anticipated to take part in a march starting at 2 p.m., which will begin at the corner of Church Street and Bloor Street. It will proceed all the way down Yonge Street to Yonge Dundas Square. Haran Vijayanathan is the executive director of the Alliance for South Asian AIDS Prevention and is the first Sri Lankan Tamil gay man to serve as the Grand Marshal of the Toronto Pride.
When I was growing up, I thought I was the only South Asian gay guy in the world because I grew up in Winnipeg, and so something was different about me, and so I only reconciled who I was as a gay man, as a gay South Asian man, when I moved to Toronto and I saw the ASAP float go by. So that's why ASAP holds a special place for me. So this is actually really an honor and quite exciting. A lot of work, but quite exciting.
For more details on the 2018 Pride event, please visit their site www.pridetoronto.com/parade.
Defenders of an Indigenous sacred site were dealt another blow on June 13th when Ottawa City Council approved a record $60.9 million grant to Windmill Development Group for the decontamination of land on two islands at Chaudière Falls. The islands on the Ottawa River near Parliament Hill had been left derelict and toxic after a century of industrial activities there. It has also unceded Algonquin territory and is considered sacred to the Algonquin and all Anishinaabe peoples. Windmill's ZB development and construction clashes with an existing Indigenous vision for Assiniboia to have Indigenous healing as well as peacebuilding and environmental harmony at the traditional spiritual gathering site. Supporters of that vision briefly disrupted the council meeting.
Any cleanup is the responsibility of the federal government under their own legislation.
Mr. Lambert, you had a chance to speak at FEDCO.
Lindsay Lambert is a historian and one of five people who attempted unsuccessfully to appeal the rezoning of the islands to the Ontario Municipal Board 4 years ago. He had expressed his objections at the previous week's Finance and Economic Development Committee hearings on the issue.
This was assented to in 1870, still in force. It establishes that Parliament has exclusive authority over everything in or on the Ottawa River, like irrespective of whether it is for the purpose of public utility or not, or built by the government or private interests. This is federal government responsibility.
1 minute.
Public messaging from Windmill before the rezoning approval suggested that the developer would take on the full costs of the cleanup. On Friday, June 22nd, faith leaders will hold the third annual Spirituality is Unity Walk for our sacred site, Akukojuan, in support of restoring the site to the Algonquin Anishinaabe. More details can be found on the event's Facebook page or at albertdumont.com. That report included files from Greg McDougall, equitableeducation.ca.
Dozens of community members walked through Winnipeg's Osborne Village on Saturday, June 16th, marking the 37th annual Walk for Peace. This year, the crowd expressed opposition to Canadian foreign policy in a number of areas, including its participation in Middle Eastern wars and its increasingly belligerent stances toward Russia and Venezuela. Speakers gathered on the west side of the Manitoba Legislative Grounds, and the Peace Alliance Winnipeg organized the walk. Glenn Michaelchuk is chair of PAW and acted as moderator.
These are just some of the issues that we're raising here today. And in some ways, they reflect really how Canada is not a force for peace in the world.
The first Walk for Peace in Winnipeg in 1982 centered around the need to stop the nuclear arms race between the United States and the then Soviet Union.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
What have you seen in your short long life? Where did your tiny feet roam? All the things you have done on top of being a wife, a mother, a daughter, a home. What have you seen in your short long life? What has your heart overcome? The traditional ways that are hidden away can be revived by the beat of a drum.
You just heard Quantum Tangle with the song Tiny Hands from the 2017 album Shelter As We Go.
Welcome back to Groundwire, your source for news from the ground up. Available online at www.groundwirenews.ca and airing on your community radio station. Now it's time for our feature stories. The 44th G7 Summit was held the weekend of June 8th and 9th in La Malbaie, Quebec. While world leaders met behind closed doors, community members and social and environmental justice campaigners mobilized in the streets to express their opposition to the G7 agenda. Gao Mahadevin of CKUT in Montreal brings us this report.
The heads of state of seven of the most powerful imperialist and colonialist countries in the world gathered on June 8th and June 9th for the G7 summit in Malbaie, Quebec. Various demonstrations were held in Quebec to protest the G7, capitalism, patriarchy, colonialism, racism, and borders. CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal brings you a sample of their coverage of the resistance efforts in Quebec City. Up first, an interview with the Rage G7, a network of groups that organized a mass demonstration on June 7th in Quebec City.
The RAG 7 is the Réseau de Résistance Anti-G7. It's a resistance network against the G7. What we expect will happen again this year is that the only resolution that will lead to actual action will be the economic resolution. And they want to ensure that the elites that benefit the most from the summit are kept safe. They want to protect the interests of this elite. So the way they do with security is in line with this position. The problem is that they're actually using this money to buy weapons, to equip the police in Quebec and in La Malbaie, to use against its own population. We're talking about spending $600 million to fight their home population. So they will arrest people. If they arrest no one, they will look like fools. So no matter what happened in the street, people will be arrested.
Nearly 70% of the summit's $604 million budget was spent on security. More than 8,000 police officers were deployed for the weekend. CKUT spoke to one of the protesters after the June 7 demonstrations about the militarization of the city.
I'm Marie-Hélène Lebel, and I'm here because I'm really concerned about everything that's going on with the G7. The event itself, the money that gets involved in security is getting really scandalous with time. And I think before we were protesting against, you know, the policies and the economical state G7 was representing, but today I think we can only be here because we believe it's scandalous that in this area of cuts and of underfinancing, we spend that much money only to hire police troops. It's kind of absurd, actually. There's so few people, and I think right now there is visibly more people that belong either in the police group or the media groups than the protesters, actually. People are kind of scared. They expect the police to charge on us. So we're kind of staying here to show that we don't believe this is a working democracy when, right from the start, police goes along with the idea that the protesters are going to be criminals. Being part of the 2012 movement, for me this is just a continuation. Actually, when you look at it, there are real guns. We see assault guns in the hands of the policemen. We see how low it goes when you see the site in La Malbaie, where you cannot really go because there are checkpoints on the way to the city of La Malbaie. So I wanted to go tomorrow, and I've seen that it's virtually impossible to get there now because they will stop you if you don't have the right pass. So logically, the only other way we have to protest is here in Quebec, and we see that they expect this to go wrong, and it's kind of a weird ending because it didn't go wrong, and all we see is the police waiting for it to happen.
Shani Piap, an Inuendet artist and activist, spoke to the mainstream press before the mass demonstration on June 7th at Parc des Brèves. She deplores the state and the G7 for the continuation of colonialist policies and the role of indigenous chiefs in accepting secondary economic agreements that enable the state to continue the displacement of indigenous peoples from their titled land.
Il faut parler en Innu. Je suis contente de parler en Innu. Je vous souhaite la bienvenue, tout le monde, sur les territoires Innu, Wendat, Algonquin, Cri, Atikamek, peuple souverain, Innu, Outapendemoun. Autrefois, nos chefs autochtones signaient des traités pour nous assurer à nous, peuple souverain, Innu, Outapendemoun, la continuité de notre vie sauvage. Nous étions une société capable de survivre tout au long de l'année dans l'immensité de notre habitat naturel. Et maintenant, les chefs autochtones de l'an 2000 acceptent des ententes économiques sur nos terres, donnant à vous, au gouvernement canadien et québécois, le droit d'envahir le peu de terres de chasse qui reste aux Premières Nations, et bientôt, avec tout le G7, sans scrupule, les chefs autochtones arrachent à leurs frères et sœurs indigènes leurs droits ancestraux sur le territoire. Tous ces territoires de survie sont dévastés de toutes parts par la politique du colonialisme et par ces chefs devenus, eux aussi, des abuseurs de société. Tous les traités d'amitié et de paix n'ont pas pu assurer notre survie en tant que premier peuple. Malgré les récentes avancées, nous périssons encore de maladies, de drogues, de boissons et de nourriture malsaine. Les nombreuses séquelles apportées par les pensionnats chrétiens à nos enfants, nos générations futures, sont impardonnables. Cela est inconciliable avec le message du Créateur que les hommes de Dieu et les bons gouvernements ont tenté de nous imposer. Votre histoire est dorénavant marquée au fer rouge par leurs agissements, et ce à jamais, que vous le vouliez ou non.
From traditional unceded Mohawk territory in Montreal, this is CKUT's Gao Mahadevan for Groundwire.
Healthcare workers in Manitoba are bracing for changes to the system, reflecting the Pallister government's austerity agenda of privatization and cutbacks. In mid-June, those workers had the opportunity to meet with a representative of a healthcare union in the Philippines, who have endured even more severe attacks on its members. Michael Welch of Winnipeg-based radio station CKUW 95.9 FM brings us the following report on that visit.
Emergency room closures, the termination of community health programs, staff shortages, and cuts to staff positions and hours have all been the result of a demand to regional health authorities in Manitoba to find millions in savings to assist in the Pallister government's overall budget balancing efforts. Faced with these challenges, the Canadian Union of Public Employees, Local 204, which represents the province's many healthcare service providers, arranged to have a distinguished visitor from the Philippines to meet with the union membership in Winnipeg to share his knowledge of more profound austerity measures that have confronted the population of his country.
In behalf of the Alliance of Health Workers, together in solidarity with UP, so we should fight against privatization and budget cuts, and also contractualization.
Robert Mendoza is a nurse practitioner and serves as national president of the Alliance of Health Workers, the largest union representing healthcare workers in the Philippines, and covers doctors, nurses, and other hospital support services. Privatization of oil, gas, electricity, and other utilities has been a demand thrust on the Philippines as a result of IMF and World Bank-imposed structural adjustment programs. As the country goes into debt, the healthcare sector, including public hospitals, are facing privatization, resulting in lower salaries and benefits for workers and reductions in services for the less well-off.
According to the Department of Health, 7 out of 10 Filipinos died without seeing any health facilities and doctors. The government is implementing the revenue enhancement program, so the user's fee. So in every procedures right now, in the different hospital or clinics, there is an amount to be paid by a certain poor patients, and this can cause some other patients, other Filipinos, doesn't want go to anymore in a health facilities. That's why the out of seven out of ten, when the Department of Health declared that like that, it should be triple Filipino will die daily because of the privatization issues.
Mr. Mendoza's union, which represents 60,000 healthcare workers, has been very effective at organizing people through petition drives and public demonstrations and solidarity actions across the sector. He believes this militancy has been key to its success in fighting back against some of the more draconian schemes being planned. Mendoza stresses that while the country's constitution and laws recognize labor rights, management still has ways of dissuading union organizing and union membership.
There are a lot of health workers being killed, being shot during their duties because they are fighting for the people's right to health and for the unionists also. So our life is being threatened also by the government and some other military police that is being hired by some other government officials. Dr. Ray from the Mindanao and Dr. Sinolanding, they were shot during their duty. So it's very sad.
Blondine Tona is originally from Cameroon. She has lived and served in Canada as a healthcare worker for 9 years. Her work with the Sexuality Education Resource Center in Winnipeg focuses on prevention as key to maintaining sexual and mental health. She's begun to worry about the impacts the Pallister government's cuts are having on the youth she has seen as clients, which is what convinced her to run as the NDP candidate in an upcoming by-election.
I'm just thinking of one person who has HIV or any STBBI. The cost of services, it will imply having meeting a doctor, will doing testing, so that all those are cost that can be prevented with a really good and solid plan. We have like thousands of people being having STBBI yearly. How do we make sure that we first dedicate some funding to not get them there in the first place?
Londine has been impressed by what Robert Mendoza has had to share in the week and a half he spent in Canada.
66,000 people with no rights, and knowing that they're organizing, and knowing that they're working really hard into making sure that the people are not going to suffer to the lack of vision of healthcare system for everybody. People are looking at us, used to look at us as example. If today our situation can be compared to what is happening there, that means we have like make a huge step back. That's what that was the moment listening to Mr. Mendoza.
The Pallister Conservatives make up a legislative majority in the Manitoba legislature. However, if the example of militancy as embodied by Robert Mendoza and his Alliance of Health Workers is any indication, there's every possibility that the provincial government's health care overhaul can be reversed or at least mitigated. From Winnipeg, on the occupied land of the Anishinaabe, the homeland of the Métis, and the traditional territory of the Nahiyawak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
June 10th was World Oceans Day. Chris Cook of radio station CFUV in Victoria, British Columbia, attended festivities at Victoria's Fisherman's Wharf and recorded the voices of those working to protect our seas.
So it's June the 10th. It's World Oceans Day. I'm down here at Fisherman's Wharf in Victoria. It's a sunny day. I'm talking to a guy that's standing beneath a massive inflated orca. Can you tell me who you are and why you're here today?
My name is Greg McElroy. I'm director of the Canadian Orca Rescue Society. I'm here to raise funds for the 4 Mile Hatchery that we have partnered up with. They're out of Port Renfrew. They have raised and released over 40 million salmon in the last 40 years. They've run out of funding from the federal government, who has cut them back. They're too busy trying to save a pipeline than to save the salmon habitat or the whales. So for $1, you can help raise 5 salmon. It's a cheap investment to a long-term future goal of saving our southern resident orca whales. We think it's important. We think everybody can do a little tiny bit, and the little bits add up to a whole picture.
My name is Alan Shirk-Shirani. I work for the Greater Victoria Harbour Authority. I'm the Environmental Projects Manager. We're looking to fundraise for the Seabin Project. And this is, in a nutshell, it's about collecting garbage from oceans. And it's a good technological tool that's available right now in the market. So we're looking to fundraise for that and see how we can clean up garbage in the water.
Standing down here, and there's a lot of tables set up for the World Oceans Day. I'm at theseashepherd.org, defending ocean wildlife worldwide. Can you tell me your name and what you do with Sea Shepherd?
My name is Benoit. I'm currently the captain on the RV Martinshin, which is the local ship that's going to be acting on the Virus Hunter campaign that's about to start in the next couple of weeks, which aims at doing research on the salmon farms that are operating a bit further north in the coastal waters of BC. So the idea is to document the water quality and what is going on in those farms. And this year, the primary focus of the campaign is going to be around resident orcas, because the southern population of resident orcas is not doing that well. And we suspect that the farms are not helping those orcas, because they have an impact on the population of wild salmon, which is a common food for the orcas. And so there are less of those wild salmon, so there's less food for the orcas. So they've been found to kind of starve and not reproduce that well.
The Georgia Strait Alliance, you guys have been, as your t-shirt says, caring for our coastal waters. Do you want to tell me what your name is and what you're doing down here today?
Yeah, my name is Octavio Cruz. I'm actually just graduating in next Wednesday from UVic's marine biology program.
Congratulations.
I'm on the species outreach protection team for Georgia Strait, and we're working specifically on raising awareness about the issues that our southern resident killer whales are facing today. Yeah. Mostly coming from two major sources. Southern residents are our most endangered killer whale on our coast. There's only 76 species, or 76 individuals of them left. And they have a very specialized diet. They only eat about 80 to 90% Chinook salmon. And that comes with a few problems for the whales. Chinook salmon are heavily impacted from a lot of different sources, including pollution from fish farms and overfishing. A lot of people, the iconic salmon photo where they're holding a huge salmon, usually they're holding a Chinook, which is also called a king salmon.
It's a fisherman's picture.
Yeah, it's the popular fisherman's photo when they're holding a giant salmon with two hands. They can barely hold it, 15 pounder or more. And that's the type of salmon that these whales need. They need these large oil, fat, and like nutrient-rich fish. And when the salmon populations go down, so do the whale population.
Well, thanks a lot for talking to me and for all you guys are doing, eh?
No, thank you for coming over.
Okay, great. Well, so there you have it, World Oceans Day down here in Victoria. For Groundwire, this is Chris Cook in Victoria.
You are listening to Groundwire, community news broadcasting from coast to coast to coast, and available online at www.groundwirenews.ca.
Now it's time for our community radio report. This week, Ome Salma Rahmtula brings us a report back on the National Community Radio Conference, held this year in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and hosted by community station CHSR 97.9 FM.
The 37th Annual Campus and Community Radio Conference was held this year from June 6th to the 10th, hosted by CHSR in Fredericton, New Brunswick. The awards ceremony, held on June 9th, honored Gunnergy O'Sullivan with the Radio Legend Award. Gunnergy is a regular contributor to Groundwire and is an important and critical voice in campus and community radio. She was introduced at the awards ceremony by a representative of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
Gunnergy served as the Aboriginal representative on the NCRA Board of Directors before it was renamed Indigenous Representative. And she was the head of the Native Caucus starting in about 2008. One of Gunnergy's major contributions was to initiate the NCRA's project called Resonating Reconciliation, which was funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And she was hired as the project's outreach coordinator. And she coordinated more than 40 community stations across Canada, campus and community, to recruit and train more than 100 Indigenous broadcasters who produced more than 70 30-minute documentaries on the ongoing legacy of Indian residential schools, each with their own unique voices and stories to tell. Gunnergy coordinated 5 Red Jam Slam live events in Vancouver, Edmonton, Winnipeg, Ottawa, and Nunavut, featuring musicians, comedians, poets, dancers, and other artists, and a radio-based slam that shared live arts programming across 4 BC community stations. Gunnergy has also been producing original radio for at least 20 years, and she at times has done as many as 5 radio shows at once at 3 different Vancouver area stations.
Gunnergy also gave one of the keynote addresses at this year's conference, where she spoke of the importance of campus community radio and her long experience in it. In this excerpt, we hear how this legend first heard radio as a child and how she first got involved with community radio in Vancouver. The excerpt ends with her message of campus and community radio's importance to society.
This is a keynote speech on why I think community and campus radio is important to the community. I am Indigenous, or so they call me. I've been listening to radio since they called us Indians. The first time I remember radio was when I was in foster home waiting for a man of great importance to come and see me. I was tiny. I was sitting beneath the shelf with a sound coming out of it. I pulled close into it and I listened until the man came. A few years went by. I went to residential school, and from there I was adopted out at the age of 7. I was adopted fresh off the Alert Bay Reservation. I found myself out back of a small town, failing to fit in. Being the one and only Indian, it felt kind of awkward. It felt wrong to be Indian. Oh, thank God for radio. The radio was always on, in the kitchen, in the living room, in the car. I do have to say that the radio was a real source of anxiety for me, especially when they would talk Indians, fisheries, trees, or God forbid, treaties. I was brought up listening to anger directed at the Indians. By 1986, I was 19. My biological brother, Raymond Williams, found me by putting a call out in a Native newspaper called Kattoo. He also told me about a radio show that he did at a station called Co-op Radio. It didn't really register me what he was actually saying, but eventually he brought me into the radio station. One day with this lady, and her name was Carrie, she was good friends with my brother, and she invited me into the station, and she got me hooked for good, if I do say so myself. Community and campus radio keeps it real. While mainstream media has a limited view, mainstream media's limited positive spins are killing us. This is why community and campus radio is important to me. Because community and campus radio stations save lives.
Congratulations to Gunnergy O'Sullivan for her award and her enormous contribution, mentorship, and commitment to community radio. Reporting for Groundwire, this is Ome Salma Rahemtula on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit.
That was our community radio report.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeg Akin, the home of the Métis Nation and the traditional territory of the Nahiowak and the Nakota. Headlines this week were written by Michael Welsh and Gao Mahadevan.
We also thank Susan Hubert, Ome Salma Rahmtula, Chris Cook, Megan Simpson and Greg McDougall for their contributions.
For CKUW, I've been your host, Kristen Andrews.
And I've been your co-host, Susan Hubert. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ca.